of all the dietary patterns that have been studied in regard to fertility or IVF, the Mediterranean diet is the one that shows up the most frequently as a pattern that increases both male and female fertility.
Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. This show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. We're Kristen Cornett and Dr. Haley Nye, your hosts and the creators of the online fertility platform, Tiny Feet. This episode is brought to you by our online preconception and fertility optimization course, Fertile in 5 Masterclass. This course walks you through everything you need to know to prepare for a healthy pregnancy so you can get pregnant when you want to, stay pregnant, and bring your healthy baby home. With over 6 hours of video lessons, printable worksheets, and quick reference guides, and links to all of our top recommended products and resources, Fertile in 5 really lays everything out for you in an easy-to-follow, step-by-step program. If you're ready to stop stressing over getting pregnant and feel confident and empowered on your fertility journey, then this is the perfect solution for you. To learn more, click on the link in the podcast episode description or go to bit.ly/fertileinfive. And if you'd like to get a free sneak peek at the full course, check out our mini course on how to choose the best prenatal supplements, which actually walks you through step 3 of Fertile in 5 Masterclass. You can get signed up for the free course through the link in the podcast episode description or by going to bit.ly/prenatal supplements. All right. Thank you all so much for tuning in with us today. If you're here for the first time, we are a nutritionist and naturopathic doctor, and our passion is helping couples get pregnant naturally and have healthier babies. We started a virtual practice through Tiny Feet, where you can schedule one-on-one consults to investigate your health and get your fertility on track. And we also offer online courses. You can learn more on our website at tinyfeet.co. And if you're local to the Portland, Oregon area, you can also find Dr. Haley at Synergy Women's Healthcare. To learn more about working with her in person, visit synergypdx.com. All right, you're listening to episode 53, where we interview naturopathic doctor, fertility specialist, and author, Dr. Elizabeth Sharavati, about how we can use diet to optimize egg quality and increase the odds of success during IVF treatment. Dr. Liz has actually been with us on the podcast before, back on episode 8 about toxins in personal care products, but we are really excited to invite her back this week to talk about her new book called IVF Meal Plan, which will be released in just a few weeks on December 3rd, 2019. The book helps educate couples about the impact of certain nutrients on fertility and then walks them through a 28-day meal plan that they can use to prepare for their upcoming treatment cycle. Throughout the episode, Dr. Liz shares with us the current state of research on nutrition for egg quality and fertility success, why it's so important for male partners to be participating in the IVF preparation process, which dietary pattern has been proven most effective for both male and female fertility, why building an integrative team can really help you personalize your IVF preparation and boost your chances of success, and how her book, IVF Meal Plan, is set up and how it's designed to be used by couples going through fertility treatment. And speaking of IVF Meal Plan, we're excited to announce that we're doing a giveaway on Instagram for the book for our listeners in both the US and Canada. You have until this coming Sunday, November 10th, to enter the giveaway, and the instructions are in today's Instagram post on our account at tinyfeet.co. You'll see the post of the podcast artwork along with Dr. Liz's lovely face, which was posted today, 11/6. So to enter, you'll like that post, tag a friend in the comments, and then make sure that you're following both us and Dr. Liz. Her handle is at elizabeth.sharavati, and her last name is spelled C-H-E-R-E-V-A-T-Y. All right, so we'll announce the winner in our stories on Monday, and we'll DM the winner for an address to ship the book. So without further ado, let me officially introduce you to Dr. Liz, and we'll get started on the interview. Dr. Elizabeth Sharavati is a naturopathic doctor and feminine leadership mentor. She is the creator of the Well-Conceived Fertility Method, an evidence-based program helping women and couples to enhance their fertility, empower their journey, and enrich the health of their future children. She's also the founder of FemPowered Global, a community that inspires women globally to embrace their feminine power and create their own definitions of, quote, having it all. Dr. Liz is a graduate of the University of Guelph and the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. She is an advocate for the potential of naturopathic and integrative perinatal care through what she calls the five trimesters, preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum, to powerfully influence children's and families' future health. Dr. Liz founded Two Rivers Health, an award-winning integrative fertility and family care clinic in the heart of Guelph, Ontario, with a vision for investing in the health and well-being of both today's and tomorrow's generations. The clinic now serves clients internationally through telemedicine, online education, and coaching. Her first book, IVF Meal Plan, will be released in December 2019. Welcome back, Dr. Liz, to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. We're so excited to have you back on to talk about your new book today.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here with you.
Absolutely. So on the previous episode, we had a chance to learn about what you do a little bit more and how you got there. But why don't you remind us, for all the new listeners, how you became a naturopathic doctor, what made you passionate about the medicine, and what inspired you to work in fertility?
Oh, sure. So I grew up with naturopathic medicine as my family's primary system of healthcare. So it was, I was quite immersed, I think, in the medicine from a young age. And I really knew that I wanted to become a naturopathic doctor by the time I was in high school. And that I knew that was my calling and continues to be. And when I was a naturopathic intern, completing my rotations, I focused on pediatrics at that time. And while I was studying pediatrics, at that time, there was some rather alarming literature coming through about how that the current generation of children was the first in known history to not be expected to outlive their own parents in terms of their lifespan. And I thought, well, something is definitely wrong with this picture. And meanwhile, in clinic, we were working with little ones, with babies and children who had chronic illness issues. And these chronic illnesses, like skin conditions like eczema or like allergies and asthma, anxiety, were showing up in children at really young ages and younger than the sort of textbooks predicted they might be normal. For example, used to be considered normal, quote unquote, for eczema to start at age 6 months with the introduction of solid foods and the other changes that are happening with kids in their nutrition and environment. And their immune system, but we were seeing kids whose eczema had started essentially from birth. So started to look a little bit backward in that chain and say, well, where did these kids' health issues really start? And started to understand that exposures or experiences that moms or even both parents had, or their conditions of their own health situation would certainly appear to have influenced the appearance of certain outcomes in kids. So I became a doula and I started supporting women and families around their births. And then I worked a lot naturopathically with pregnancy conditions and optimizing health in pregnancy. And then I realized that everything that we're doing to support a healthy pregnancy and then a healthy child would also have needed to begun, if possible, before conception. And that's where we came kind of full circle. And I think you and I first met, Haley, on that common ground of our passion for preconception and realizing the investment that we make in preconception and considering that like a season. So I'm now considering that like a trimester in and of itself. Can have a significant impact on not only fertility and pregnancy health, but of course also children's future health potential. And so that's where I ended up focusing on fertility, because everything that we're doing to invest in preconception health just so happens to also enhance fertility.
Yes. Yeah. Amazing. Partners.
Yeah, and I love that you dropped the preconception trimester, because this is a new concept in research that's coming out. I've seen it in the most recent research in 2019, where they're now calling it the preconception trimester, and we also posted that on our Instagram. And so I really like that. I feel like it makes sense to people more than just like the preconception care. Like, it's the trimester really puts more definition on it. Like, oh, 3 months before pregnancy. So I love that. I love how we can advocate for, you know, that as something that just is standard, that women know that that's what they need to do and strive for before they become pregnant. So I love that. Yes. So it's also interesting how you started with children and then you're just like, well, okay, what else can I do to be more preventative? Oh, what else can I do to be more preventative? And you really just made that transition from like kiddos all the way to preconception care, because, you know, Kristen and I are very aligned with you on that, of like, that's really where the prevention starts.
Yes. Amen to that. And it is really cool that that's coming through specific literature today, because we did not have that terminology when we were all students in medical school or nutrition school, right? And this is very honoring, I think, to women's health in general, right? And and to the very specific events that happen in both men and women in regard to their fertility and the epigenetics that are being like programmed in advance of conception toward whatever that 50% of the genetic component from the egg and 50% from the sperm are going to be. And that's very exciting. Like, it's the ultimate preventative medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's really exciting. So not only are you super passionate in preconception care, but you also are working with a lot of women and couples with infertility, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you recently wrote a book to help women who are struggling with infertility. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. The book is called IVF Meal Plan, and it is specifically focused on food and nutrition for egg quality in advance of IVF. So it happens that with fertility and nutrition research, a lot of the focus of those studies is in the context of IVF. Mm-hmm. And that's probably because IVF is expensive, it's invasive, it's not without risk, and there's a lot riding on it in every way. And so, you know, researchers and physicians and couples want to make that one IVF, that very next cycle or their very first cycle, count. And so there's been a lot of research in, okay, what are the factors that seem to be correlated with IVF success or higher success rates, pregnancy, and of course, live birth. We want a baby at the end of that cycle. So we want to prevent miscarriage when there are pregnancies happening. And so that's been a focus on some of the research in recent years. And that's really exciting because there have been some significant findings in the field of nutrition, and that includes food and supplements. So the book is focused on food, and I talk a little bit about specific supplements too that have been shown to have benefits in IVF, usually IVF studies and or IVF and PCOS studies, and that's another area of strong research. But really, we can extrapolate that for most women, whether they are going into IVF or not, or who are planning for natural conception, would benefit from these changes. So the reason why we're focused on IVF is actually that you get just a lot more data from that type of a study, because the eggs are actually retrieved from the woman's body and embryos are actually cultivated in a way that they can be visualized under a microscope and looked at. And then of course we have the outcome that we're studying of pregnancies and babies born.
So I was just thinking, like, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners that hear the term IVF, but maybe they just aren't familiar with it. They're not there in their journey. Hopefully they don't need to be there, but let's kind of back up and just explain kind of what IVF is, just real quick, like a little snippet.
Yeah, sure. IVF stands for in vitro fertilization. And this is kind of like the gold standard medical approach to infertility. Now, it was originally designed to get around the idea, like a woman having blocked tubes. So if a woman is ovulating and releasing an egg but has been unable to get pregnant, sometimes the reason is that one or both of her fallopian tubes, which allow the egg to travel down and meet up with the sperm and be fertilized, if one of those or both of those is blocked, there's a significantly less decreased chance of natural conception, because the egg and the sperm cannot physically get together in that space in the reproductive system. So eggs are, they're treated, the woman is given medication to enhance the number of eggs that mature so that several of them can be removed from her ovary. And then her partner's sperm or sperm donor sperm is mixed with those eggs and embryos are created. And then one or two of those embryos, provided that they are healthy looking embryos, will be transferred directly into the womb at the time that she would, in a natural cycle, have implantation happening.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. And when it comes back to egg quality, that I believe is one reason probably you're really so motivated to make this or to write this book, is because when it comes to retrieving those eggs. So you say that we're giving women medication that's through like the stimulation phase. And the purpose of that is to create a lot of follicles so we can retrieve as many eggs as possible. So we're forcing this maturation process of follicles, and then they're retrieving those eggs. But what happens is there's a funnel system with IVF to where you retrieve maybe 15 eggs and then only, let's say, 7 or 8 fertilize with the sperm, and only a small percentage of those fertilized eggs, about maybe 30% or 20%, and of course it depends on egg quality, is actually going to become an embryo. And then that embryo also, nowadays with fertility clinics, they're testing them for genetic, like chromosomal abnormalities. And so they get tested, and then usually about 40% of them, and it totally depends on age, is going to be normal. So it's this funnel process. And so this idea of using nutrition to really boost egg quality before you get the egg retrieval is really quite a big investment in the success of that, of you actually walking away with viable chromosomally normal eggs that can be, or embryos that can be implanted.
Exactly. And that's the value of preconception or a season before your IVF, to take in those foods and those nutrients that can take the quality and health of those follicles and the eggs within them to the highest possible level before that funneling down process that you mentioned, where only a percentage of the eggs or embryos will essentially make it to the next stage of the IVF and actually either be transferred or hopefully be a successful transfer and a successful pregnancy.
Yep. Yeah. I love how much data we have on this now. Like the amazing advances in modern science that have allowed us to study how we can intervene in this process to make healthier eggs and create healthier embryos and hopefully healthier babies. Obviously IVF is expensive and invasive, and it's emotional to go through. There are a lot of factors. I mean, dealing with infertility, all of that is very difficult to go through, but we really have to give props to modern science for all of the incredible research that we're getting out of this process to show not just how we can improve outcomes in IVF, but how we can improve outcomes for couples in general from a preconception perspective.
Absolutely. It's been a fantastic time of receiving that data. And we do have IVF to thank for that. And for all of the women in particular, right, who are going through it. Yeah. To thank them for the understanding that we now have at the level of what is happening in the follicle and in the ovary. That is amazing. And I think that we're really only just scratching the surface of what we know about eggs and follicles.
Yeah, I agree. I was just saying, like, oh my gosh, we still have so much more to know, which is really unfortunate mm-hmm. because, you know, when patients or clients come to us, they really want to know all the answers. And as a humble physician, we really need to say we don't have all the answers. We still have so much further to go in research to really understand exactly what's going on. The reproductive process is really quite magical. You know, there's so much going on that we just don't know about.
Yeah, we don't know why male fertility can go on for these, you know, the eighth decade of their lives, with the right support, of course, but that it's essentially unchanged as long as that man is nourished and not under different types of stressors that affect that. That affects sperm quality, but female fertility is like genetic on programmed on a telomere or genetic level mm-hmm. that it will quiet down, and that, you know, that our menopause, our lifespan has increased significantly over our ancestors, we believe, but our reproductive lifespan for women hasn't substantially increased. Now, there are certainly cases. There are definitely cases of natural fertility into the 40s, even to like age 50. I recently met someone who had her own natural, she called it her oops, her happy surprise, when she was 45. And she said, but that's, you know, that's not that amazing, because my friend had her first baby at age 50 naturally.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. I mean, you definitely think that there are some serious, like, you know, good genes going on there, because there is a big genetic component to some of this, but also there are a lot of other factors. Food and nutrition is one of those factors, but also the ability to utilize nutrients in a specific way in the body is partly determined by genetic pathways.
Yeah, and that's right.
And I also think that, you know, the epigenetic piece is another area of research that we're getting so much fascinating information, particularly when it comes to how the male DNA is programmed and how that impacts not just the health of the baby, but even research about how it can affect the health of the woman's pregnancy.
Absolutely.
Which is crazy to me. Yeah. Like, my partner's sperm quality affects whether or not I might develop a complication during pregnancy. I think the specific research I've seen so far is on gestational diabetes, but that's kind of a mind blown sort of a moment that what your partner is doing before you conceive affects potentially what your outcomes are and whether or not you suffer from a particular complication.
That's right. And that's amazing. And also sperm quality being correlated with miscarriage risk.
Right. And
so many women that struggle with pregnancy loss, or couples that struggle with it, it's totally easy to assume that this is about female health. But it can be, it really is about both partners being in it together. You're both calling in this new life together. Mm-hmm. And this has been borne out by very modern research, which is very exciting to know.
Yeah.
So men, we need you. We need you to be 100% on board in this process. You're not a passive observer, you're not just the source of a semen sample. You are a father to be, just as women, we're creators and mothers mm-hmm. to be. Mm-hmm.
So that kind of brings up a question about your book, because you have put together, I think it's 4 7-day meal plans. So it's 28 days worth of meal plans for IVF prep. Is this something that kind of brings in the male partner in the book to encourage both partners to do this together so that they can kind of both optimize this preparation phase?
Yes, absolutely. I do specifically encourage the readers, which the book is geared toward women. Let's face it, we're the ones mostly talking about this and leading the way, mm-hmm. as we do for all areas of health and wellness, for our family, for our communities. And that's very, you know, inherent in kind of the feminine. And I highly encourage male partners to cook together with their partner and to eat that healthy way. And we talk in the book about kind of like the foods that we definitely want to enrich into the diet. And we do focus on egg quality because that is really the direction that the book is taking. And there's reasons for that. And we can talk about sort of chromosomal abnormalities as we kind of alluded to just previously. But more holistically, the research that we do have available for sperm health and diet or nutrition, it's very much similar. So principles are, we want a Mediterranean focused diet. So of all the dietary patterns that have been studied, in regard to fertility or IVF, the Mediterranean diet is the one that shows up the most frequently as a pattern that increases both male and female fertility. But let's break that down. The fertility diet is based on Mediterranean. That means, though, less red meat, more poultry or fish or seafood for kind of protein, less grain, more legumes, no refined anything, like no white stuff, no white flour, white sugar, processed foods, additives, of course. So that's a less inflammatory diet, less omega-6 or vegetable oils, and more omega-3 and omega-9 from olive oil. And for fertility purposes, we're going to skip most of that red wine, if not all. but the red wine, of course, yes, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, but what if it's gluten-free?
Gluten-free grain?
Yeah. I think there's this concept of like, well, if it's a gluten-free bagel or gluten-free bread or it's gluten, you know, like there's this misconception of like, oh, it's healthy if it's gluten-free.
Oh, but I see. Yes.
What you're saying is like no refined anything.
Yeah.
Even the gluten-free treats or / yeah. foods, right?
That's such a good point because there are so many processed foods that are marketed as health foods.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that's so true.
And so they're using buzzwords that we're all susceptible to. I eat almost exclusively gluten-free, but I don't replace most of that otherwise gluten-containing grain with processed or white bread products that are meant to like mimic the texture of a pizza crust or a bagel. Mm-hmm. So once in a while, those aren't going to make a difference, but if it's like the everyday thing and it's simply a replacement, that would not be falling in the category of what we know to be the fertility diet.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of people don't realize how much of those things they eat until they actually track it sometimes. Like I have kind of a funny example of this. So my husband and I cut gluten out of our diet about 6 or 7 years ago. And he's like, oh, this isn't going to be that hard. Like I don't eat that much of it. And then he kind of thought about what he's really eating. He's like, oh, so I had like a breakfast sandwich for breakfast and I had a sandwich for lunch and I had some pasta or whatever for dinner. And he's like, oh, I actually eat quite a bit of this kind of processed grain, happen to be gluten containing grain. But yeah, I think it's, mm-hmm. I think that is an area of difficulty. I think when we think about how we eat, we tend to overestimate the healthy foods that we consume and kind of underestimate the less healthy foods we consume, which is why it's really nice to have more of a meal plan type of approach when you have really high stakes, because IVF is high stakes.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, like readers will see in the meal plans that there's really little bread. Like it's just optional. If you're gluten-free, choose the most whole grain gluten-free option and maybe it's a piece of bread on the side of our, you know, cream of mushroom soup once a week, right? So I wanted to give lots of options that don't involve reliance on breads and pastas. Mm-hmm. And there is a, you know, there's a little bit of oats in the plans and, but none of the recipes require gluten containing grains because for many people, those do tend to be inflammatory.
Yeah.
One from an intolerance or an immunological perspective, but two from just how much concentrated carbohydrate ends up in a serving of bread or pasta. Mm-hmm. And it's then the insulin And the inflammation that follows insulin, or the metabolic shifts that follow too much insulin, that are themselves inflammatory or in hormone imbalancing. So if we're in a high carbohydrate intake state, we're going to have high insulin. We're going to build tissue. So we need a little bit of insulin. But we don't, insulin usually overshoots the mark because it's kind of like, it's our survivor genes that are making sure that whenever we're in contact with carbohydrates, our bodies just like soak that up and use it to build tissue. Cause in nature, there aren't like packages of high density carbohydrates lying around in the fields and forests. And that is definitely like a post agriculture phenomenon.
For sure.
There's not like a cake tree somewhere.
A cookie tree. Yeah. I wish there was a sourdough tree. I would climb that one to get.
But, access all that nutrition with fermentation. Well, I think there's sort of this misconception. And in the US, this has really been perpetuated by this USDA food pyramid, even though it's not called that anymore. And it's been redesigned to look like something different. It's called MyPlate now. But it really perpetuates this idea that grains are super nutrient dense. And there is some good nutrition in grains, but there's less nutrient density in those foods than there are in other foods, like what we're talking about focusing on in a more Mediterranean type of template. Legumes have more nutrition than grains do. Vegetables, fruits have more nutrition than grains do. And in a lot of cases, vegetables and legumes also contain more fiber, which slows down the absorption of that carbohydrate. So grains are less nutrient dense and super starchy.
Yes, and insulin stimulating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's a similar paradigm in Canada. This is where I live. And, you know, for as long as I can remember, when I'd speak to my naturopaths about nutrition, and, you know, we, for example, my sister was intolerant to dairy. Mm-hmm. She would get like chronic ear infections, and it's just a marker of that inflammatory nature to certain foods. And that's a little bit arbitrary and that's individual, but for her, she needed to be taken off dairy. And, you know, there was a conversation about, well, is that okay? Is she getting her milk? Is she getting enough milk? And, you know, we would say, well, dairy isn't really a food group, even though that was defined in the Canada Food Guide. Yeah. As like an entire section, like a group, you got to make sure there's one dairy product on every meal. And very recently it was officially taken off the Canada Food Guide, and there was such a discomfort with that culturally. It hasn't been accepted, and it's hard even for a modern generation of parents right now, because they feel very confused about how they could possibly get enough calcium. But it's the same for women and men who are trying to become pregnant or become parents. Some foods that are traditionally, or let's say culturally normal or expected, and we rely on them because they're convenient and so on and tasty, that might be not what your body is asking for. And responding in the best way. So if your body, and this is where it's worthwhile to work with a professional and individual basis, because if your body is responding to certain foods, whether they're, you know, nutrient dense or not, if you're eating it often enough and it's creating an inflammatory response, that's going to shift your fertility physiology out of the harmony that you want it to be in.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of important considerations for, you know, a food might be healthy, but just like you're saying, it might be inflammatory for you at that moment, like based on what you have going on. Like we talk a lot about the gut on our podcast. Yes. And, you know, something like a grain could be really challenging to a digestive system that's already compromised. And that's kind of why, you know, we have advocated a lot for short-term eliminations to kind of figure out like which foods are working for your body and how do we heal whatever that underlying issue is so that we can tolerate nutrient-dense foods. Like not everybody tolerates legumes really well, but that just usually indicates that there's some underlying healing work that can be done. And then that nutrient dense, very beneficial food can be added back into the diet without issue so that you can receive the benefit that it can provide you for something like IVF prep.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I also wanted to go back to the idea of dairy, because in the current research with the Mediterranean diet being like the front runner of what is typically used in conventional medicine or fertility clinics, they don't exclude dairy. And in fact, full fat dairy products has actually been shown to be helpful. But in that point, you know, and our listeners know that we've talked many times about removing dairy as a potential inflammatory food because it is so common. So gluten and dairy is just so very common, especially in conditions like endometriosis or PCOS. And so what does a listener do if they're at a fertility clinic and their doctor's like, yeah, full fat dairy, fine, go ahead and eat it, no problem. Like, but maybe they intuitively know they might have an issue with it. If they are not eating dairy, do you feel like that's going to affect their egg quality or their chances of, you know, having successful IVF cycle?
Oh, that's such a good question. So in the available research to date, what the status of the dairy question seems to be is if you eat dairy, make it full fat. I've seen advice in various books and so on to eat like full fat ice cream instead of frozen yogurt. And I just feel like that's not really the message of the data, right? It's not really about taking one highly processed and sugar rich food, and replacing it with a low fat version of same. So again, I think that the conversation about individualized nutrition might do well to happen even outside of the fertility clinic, because there are health professionals who are extremely highly trained in clinical nutrition. And that, in my experience, hasn't been a role that the fertility specialists are looking to take on anyway, right. Nor would they claim that it's their training.
Right.
And
I agree.
And so in my own experience, I haven't had too many patients taken off a nutrition plan that we've advised or recommended or discovered that a patient needed to follow. I've never had a patient's plan criticized by saying, why aren't you eating dairy? They don't actually really look at that level, at least in the clinics that we kind of collaborate with here locally.
And that's my experience here in Oregon too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it comes back to restoring you're all doing an amazing job at this, restoring the power and the control and decision-making and the leadership in one's fertility journey to the patient, to the person going through that. Yeah. Ultimately, we are connected on a deep level to what we know to be true and right for us. And there's an awful lot of confusing messaging. There's a lot of noise in the online space. And so what we want to do is help every person take advantage of the full scope of each of their team's expertise and can jointly help her move toward her ultimate goal. And I think that naturopathic medicine and nutrition have such a powerfully supportive role to play in even as something as medical as IVF to help that person feel better through the process, feel as best as she's ever felt going into it. And anecdotally, that has really correlated with success. When you're as healthy as you've ever been, you go into that IVF expecting and success and feeling competent and feeling less stressed and worried. But also that health that you've brought to the table is going to affect how your treatment works. Medication, surgery, anything medical works better in a healthy person than it does in a person who's suboptimally well. And so that's the goal with integrative fertility care and with the nutrition that that we talk about in the book and with all of the supportive measures that you're encouraging your audiences to take.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would also say, just going back to the dairy thing one more time, because I had this thought of like, I believe the reason why the full fat dairy is so beneficial when people are tolerating it well is because of the probiotic content in dairy, because most of it's fermented, and then also the calcium and some of the other things that you're getting. So it is important to understand that if you decide not to have dairy, like Kristen and I here, like we don't eat dairy, to be cautious about, or conscious, not cautious, conscious about how much calcium that you're getting. And then we always mm-hmm. encourage a probiotic or some other type of fermented food, such as sauerkraut or, you know, kimchi or other type of like probiotic rich foods. So if you're not doing dairy, that's, I guess, another big benefit of working with somebody one-on-one, of saying, let's take this out, but let's still keep like the beneficial things of in your diet that you would be getting if you ate dairy on a daily basis.
That's right. And to your point, with fertility, despite the various narratives out there, there's nothing magical about dairy, full fat dairy in particular, or dairy right. in general. It's not that you have to eat full fat dairy in order to get pregnant. In fact, there are many, many cultures throughout history that have been essentially dairy free, or if they had milk products, it was always fermented before refrigeration. So drinking cow's milk, especially pasteurized cow's milk, is very modern. And I'm not sure that it's been best for our levels of metabolic issues like diabetes or pre-diabetes. Perhaps another reason why full fat dairy could be the type of dairy that is, if for people are taking it, is the one to choose, could be about how the fat content in the milk products will slow the absorption of the carbohydrate. And
oh, good point.
So milk products are generally quite insulin stimulating, even though they contain protein. And that's why it's popularized and research-based to take in like chocolate milk or something like a shake containing milk after a workout, because it stimulates the insulin, which will drive those building blocks into our muscles for, for bulking up or for strengthening your muscles. There are other ways to stimulate insulin. Like with any carbohydrate, we'll do that. But milk is more insulin stimulating than we would expect given the protein ratio that's present there. So perhaps, and this is a little bit speculative on my part, I would have to, verify that there are studies comparing this, but I suspect that the fat content in full fat dairy is, and the slowing effect of that is probably beneficial to overall insulin levels and blood sugar balance versus skim or non-fat versions. And that might bring us to fat in general as a conversation about egg quality and fertility. And there's so much fear about dietary fats. Mm-hmm. And there's so much popular conversation, I would say, about low fat and fat. Fat doesn't make us fat. Fat does not stimulate insulin. And high quality fats are very, very crucial for successful fertility. They are anti-inflammatory. They they plug into our cell membranes. They plug into the egg membrane and the follicle environment. So the fear of fat is one thing that we could address too. And there are basically people need to know that there's inflammatory fats and there's anti-inflammatory fats. Mm-hmm. And we want to err on the side of the anti-inflammatory fats, which is, as we mentioned earlier, your omega-3s, which are from fish and seafood or omega-3 supplements and from olive oil or almonds or the omega-9s, avocados, which don't seem to, which have a very different physiological response than fried oils. Hydrogenated oils are definitely need to be out. We know that from the literature as well, which are like shortening and a lot of the fryer oils. They're a lot more regulated here in Canada recently, but they still show up. Yeah,
I know. I was
that's
like,
good. That's good to know. That's not happening here in the U.S. yeah, I mean, I think the rule is that if it requires high heat extraction and chemical processing in order to make it into like a tub or a container, plastic clear container that you buy at the store, it's really not the best choice. And, I think there's a lot of fear about saturated fat too. And I think what the important discussion to be having around fat is that we need all of the different types of fatty acids, but you need them from whole food sources in balanced amounts, not to be like massively over-consuming one. If you were going to over-consume one, over-consume omega-3. But the balance is really the important thing, because all of these different types of fatty acids have physiological functioning and are supportive to health when they're part of a balanced diet.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's really important that we help women and men to understand the differences and the physiologic need for these different types of fats and why they're not bad for us, and how to understand whether the fat that we're taking in is in that balance that you suggest, Kristen.
Yeah.
So speaking on that, back to your meal plan, what kind of, could you give us some examples of like what a balanced meal or a day would look like? Maybe you could just give us like one day out of your meal plan.
Sure. Yeah. So we've taken a lot of kind of familiar favorites and tweaked them so that they're more in line with the fertility diet. And so we have beanless turkey chili. So let me go back into the beginning of the day. So every day starts with breakfast. For those who do fasting, you can, if that works for you and you know that that's a way to manage blood sugar or insulin or weight, that's cool. It might not be for most people, and it might not be for many women, because women tend to run on a more depleted kind of pace, and we need to restore nutrients first. So the diet will be breakfast, lunch, dinner. There are recommended snacks each day. You can have a snack if you're hungry. It's not required. There's not a lot of calorie counting, but just familiar favorites that contain like a block of protein, about 20 grams is a good way to start the day, a fertility friendly fat, and then lots of vegetables, and then fruit based dessert. If you want a dessert, they're all designed to have quick preparation. We give you tips on how to prepare certain things in advance if you want to do that, and how to make certain things into batches that you can have for leftovers for your lunches. And they're all designed around what ingredients are easily available in grocery stores. Whether you shop online or go into the store, you should be able to find absolutely everything easily.
Oh, that's so nice. Because sometimes you get recipe books and you're like, I have no idea what this is. And do I have to go to like an Asian market or something to get that? And then you just get
The flour.
That's like my experience.
Yeah. And especially if you're kind of going gluten-free, there's a lot of books that are very complex, kind of flour mixtures or different filler or binder mixtures that we don't do anything like that. The recipes are all created by, a friend, Charleston Delano, who's an amazing Whole Foods chef, and he and his wife, Katrina, who's a registered acupuncturist, run a clinic here in Southern Ontario, and they have a lot of fertility experience as well with their clientele. And that was a really neat partnership to be able to work together. So that's how we've laid it out. It's easy to follow. It's not meant to feel restrictive or particularly inflexible. So you can do substitutions, and it's easy. We give you some kind of tip with every recipe of either substituting ingredients. So for example, if you're dairy free, you're going to use, you know, this amount of coconut milk in place of this dairy, or, mm-hmm. So almost every single recipe, it has something to do with that. And none of them has refined sugar. And all of them is designed to be really flavorful and to just make you feel good.
I love it. That sounds incredible. It sounds incredible for even somebody who might not be going through IVF, who just really needs.
That's what I was just thinking. Like, this sounds great for anybody.
Yeah, to start a fertility diet and to learn how to eat more whole foods and to learn how to build a meal that's nourishing. Like, even if you're just at the beginning of your journey, like, pick this up and use it as a jumping off point for like preconception. I mean, I totally get why it's geared specifically toward IVF, because high stakes. You know, we already talked about that. And because we have so much great research to show how specific foods and nutrients impact that IVF process in a positive way. But yeah, this is definitely a multi-purpose resource that you've created.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, I hope it will be. Yeah, it could definitely be used for non-IVF fertility self-care. Absolutely.
And there's a lot of education in the book too. It's not just the recipes, but it actually explains like some of the science of like the egg and sperm quality and how those nutrients impact that too. So they're getting a healthy dose of education along with their meal plans.
I have a question. That's about right. Like, so it's a 28-day meal plan, but if somebody's planning to go into IVF, like when would you ideally have them start this meal plan?
I would love for them to be using the meal plan and or our overall guidelines at least 3 months before their IVF. The reason for that is when we go back to that idea of preconception trimester, there are really, really significant and important changes that happen at the level of the egg about 3 months before it would be either retrieved through an IVF cycle or ovulated naturally in a natural cycle. And similarly, it takes about 3 months to produce healthier brand new sperm. And when both parents to be are eating in this way, we know that there are benefits. So in that sort of T minus 3 months before a particular egg gets released for ovulation, there's a shift from a kind of state of, I call it suspended animation in the book, from the time of our birth as newborn girls. We've had our eggs that are just maturing. They were maturing in fetal life as we were developing in our mother's womb. And then they pause partway through the second stage of their final maturation. They're just waiting. They're just in the wings. And when it's almost time for them to take the stage, they go through this recruitment process, which invests a lot of energy, nutrients. That's where we see the importance of coenzyme Q10 and carnitine and anti-inflammatory fats and all of the hormonal signaling that can actually be influenced by our food, by our everyday diet. We're influencing how much insulin is causing an interaction with the other hormones of our body. So for example, if our insulin is quite high and chronically, like day in and day out, too high, it will allow too much testosterone to be released from its, there's like a package that it's bound in the bloodstream. Sex hormone binding globulin. So under that condition and environment in your body, then the maturation of your follicles or your eggs or your ovulation could be slowed or delayed or compromised because there's too much testosterone stopping that ovulation from happening properly. So that's why some time, like a couple of months, is very, very valuable because our bodies don't change overnight, but they do change over time.
Yeah.
And when we put in the right resources and remove the obstacles, gosh, the body can heal and a fertile, a healthy body will conceive. Mm-hmm. Fertility is about health, first and foremost. It's not a disease. Infertility is not really a disease. It's just a condition that's an interaction between the internal and the external environment. And that's really why food is so important, because it is the bulk of our exposure to the quote unquote environment that interacts with our genetic expression. And that the level of our DNA, we're sending information molecules through our food, as well as through what happens when we think certain thoughts and what happens when we're exposed to stressful experiences. All of that interacts with our genome as well. So I want to help. I want to help as many people as possible to speak to their genes in a fertility promoting way.
I love that.
Oh, I can't think of a better way to like package up that message. Yeah, that was an awesome explanation of mm-hmm. why this is so important, of what we're trying to achieve and kind of how we can do that. So mm-hmm. I think that's kind of a fabulous note to end on. What do you guys think?
I love that.
Sounds good.
So I had two thoughts real quick, is that I've been a big proponent of calling it subfertility instead of infertility, even though we don't actually say subfertility. So maybe we could start that trend, Kristen. But
good idea.
Yeah, because infertility really puts a negative thought in people's minds, you know, especially women. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm infertile. And it's like, I feel like it rips away their hope. But if you call it subfertility, it's like, oh, all I just need to do is like just a little bit of work. You know, I got to like get up to that fertile point. I'm a little subfertile right now. So there's that. And then what was my other thought? It had to do with IVF. Oh, if you start this meal plan 3 months in advance, so it sounds like you would do it like three times, right? 28 days, three times.
Yeah.
Maybe you might end up, you know, getting pregnant before you actually start your stimulation cycles.
So. I'm sure that you've seen that happen in the patients that you've worked with in your practice, that you've kind of put on like an IVF prep and that does happen sometimes. I feel like not only the nutrition and all of that, but also regaining the control in the process too is so empowering. Yes. And I think that that has an impact on the stress of the process, and that can have a positive effect as well.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Barring, of course, those anatomical issues like blocked or absent tubes and aspects like that. Yes, it is possible and probable that when we infuse health back into our systems, that the fertility will come back on board. It's how we all got here. Fertility is normal. It's common. Right now we have what's been called a growing emergency. Mm-hmm. Globally, with 1 in 6 couples everywhere, like across nations, across ethnicities. It's a global problem. It's not normal. It's significantly abnormal that 1 in 6 couples would struggle to reproduce. Mm-hmm. Like when we look at it from a species or organism's perspective.
That's a scary trend.
It's a scary thing, and there's a ton that we can be doing about it, and it's just a matter of getting that education and empowerment out there. And I love what you two are offering to your audience, so commend you. Please keep sharing. This is awesome. Thank you so much for the conversation today.
Yeah. One last thing. Tell us when the book comes out.
Yeah, it comes out December 3rd, 2019.
Okay. And it is on pre-order right now on Amazon, correct?
It's on pre-order as we speak today.
I'm gonna order mine today.
That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. You've done a lot of work for me. So I'm going to have it in my clinic and be like, okay, just do this meal plan.
Thank you.
We will link to that in the show notes. And Dr. Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate all of the knowledge and expertise that you shared with us. And we can't wait to continue to share this amazing resource with our audience.
Thank you so much, ladies.
Appreciate you.